I think one of the hardest parts of life is discovering and remembering who we are. On this show, we've talked about how the ways we learn to express ourselves shape our relationships with everything around us. But how often do we pause to question the complexity behind the tools and letters we use to write, or the importance of diversity in our writing systems? Today, we are joined by Tim Brooks, writer, researcher, artist, and founder of the Endangered Alphabets Project. He's been published in the New York Times Magazine, the Atlantic Monthly, and National Geographic. But through the Endangered Alphabets Project, he explores the deeper realities of writing systems dying, a loss most people rarely consider, yet one with profound consequences for communities, cultures, and humanity as a whole. In this conversation, we talk about the power of scripts beyond words on a screen as vessels of memory, identity, and resistance. Welcome to Echoes of Meaning.
So everything starts from a single point, but then it radiates in so many directions that this conversation could go almost anywhere. So it all begins with Christmas presents, with me carving signs for my family for Christmas presents in 2008. And I had no background in carving or visual art or linguistics or anthropology. So I had the benefit of naivety. I made these signs for family members, and I enjoyed it so much, I then went on and asked everybody to come up with a Chinese character that they felt somehow stood for them, was an icon. So I did a series of Chinese carvings, and I liked that so much, I decided I would look for another script to carve. And I had been in southern India for National Geographic a few years previously, and I had seen a Malayalam, which is the language and script of the state of Kerala in southern India. And I thought it was entirely new to me, something completely unlike anything that I'd seen before. And I thought maybe I would try carving some text in Malayalam. And I just Googled Malayalam, and I came across omniglot.com, which, you know, many of your listeners will know. It's essentially an online encyclopedia of the world's writing systems. And I was flabbergasted because I'm a fairly well-traveled person, but so many of these I had never heard of. And as I was going through page by page, I kept seeing no longer used for official purposes, no longer taught in schools, only used by priests, only used by map makers, only used by women to write secret love letters. And I thought, I felt several things. I was astonished at the visual variety. Many of them looked completely unlike anything I thought of as writing in my ignorance. And I was struck by how many of them were endangered or on the verge of extinction. And I decided that there and then that I would carve some text in a number of these as a way of preserving them and making them literally more solid. And I had no idea how ambitious a project this actually was. But I decided that if I set up an exhibition of these, and if I invited other people to exhibit as well, then I couldn't back out. I trapped myself. And it's just as well I did, because many of them were far more work than I expected. But as I was doing them, I got fascinated not by what script family they were in, because I didn't know any of that stuff, and not by trying to actually read them and pronounce them, because I didn't have that background, but just by what they looked like. And I kept asking myself, how does this script look like this? And it was a little bit like Charles Darwin and the Galapagos, you know. So why are the tortoises on each island different? If the script arrived here, why did it vary so much in different places? And that was when I started researching and keeping notes. And that became my book, Endangered Alphabets, which came out in late 2010. And from then on, things just exploded and went literally all over the world.
And I assume that when you started seeing all that variety of different scripts and wondered about why are they so different, you started seeing your own script as something particular. And I am not talking about your handwriting, but about, yeah, the alphabet, the Latin alphabet, you know?
That's a great question. So that didn't start happening. So one of the things about being a member of a privileged culture is that for quite a while, you can look at other cultures and be interested in them, but without realizing it, you're looking at them still as a member of a privileged culture. So for example, if you go to the zoo, you can be really interested in the animals, but you can still believe in animals in the zoo as being somehow distinct from and even inferior to human beings. And it wasn't until, first of all, I went to Bangladesh, actually not for the endangered alphabets. I went there to do some public health work, but I had put the word out that I was interested in anyone contacting me from a minority culture. And I met three people from three different minority cultures who were essentially actively being marginalized and essentially being in a situation of cultural genocide. And that really changed my point of view from being curious and interested and fascinated to being really much more of an advocate and realizing that I needed to get involved. I couldn't just look at this stuff. I needed to do something about it.
And when you started looking into all these differences and varieties, did you try like to use the scripts to express something, or could you perceive what the message was from?
I wasn't thinking at the time in terms of message, except in very, very general terms. So the first exhibition I did, in each case, the text was Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says something like, all peoples were created alike in dignity and respect. They were endowed with reason and conscience and should behave toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood. And I thought that was very ironic, because it's a very noble sentiment, but many of these scripts are endangered because people haven't behaved toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood. But the more I worked on this, the more I got interested in the individual scripts and their individual letters as expressions of that culture. So clearly, they are also expressions of the spoken language. But I was sort of fascinated by how the letters came to look like they do. And that turns out to be an expression of not only the culture and its history, but also its history of religion. So if you have, for example, a culture that has been very influenced by Islam, then the letters will probably go from right to left and will look a certain way. If you have a culture that is largely written on palm leaves, then that will radically affect what the letters look like because of the medium and what you can and can't do with a palm leaf. If you have a culture that has inscribed its writing on bamboo, it's going to look different yet again. And flip that over, what that means is that every script speaks about its culture of origin. And you realize that you can't just say, oh, why don't you use a different script because it's more widely used or more popular? That's like saying, why don't you give up all of your traditional music and do hip-hop because everybody does hip-hop, you know? Or why don't you give up your traditional dress and wear T-shirts because everybody loves a T-shirt? And that's when the real kind of anthropological / human rights element of this became more and more apparent.
Yes, you're talking about massification.
Yes.
When you talk about, yes, the texture of the surface you're writing on, yes, it says something about your culture and your mindset and your...
In your history, yes. And your identity, yes, because you can't take away someone's past without taking away their sense of who they have been and who they are and what their values are and what they believe in, and therefore how they will face the world going forward. That's something that not many people realize, is if you take someone's past away, you take away their sense of how to navigate their future and how to have a future that they feel invested in and emboldened in.
Yes, we're talking about the tools that we use to express ourselves, right?
Also true, yes.
Yes.
And of course, this is something that we face in the United States in a very, very immediate way, because there is this headlong rush to throw away the tools that have been used for centuries, the tools that became shaped to the hands of the people, that were understood and reliable, that people knew how to fix, right? So now we're heading into a future where almost nobody knows how to fix the tools. So, you know, if you drop your laptop, it's going to cost you, you know, $1,500, $2,000 for a new laptop. Whereas the tools that people were using 100 years ago, they knew how to sharpen, they knew how to mend, they knew how to improve. And we're getting further and further away from that sense of kind of manual agency.
And I think that also changes your relationship with your craft, no?
Yep.
And not talking craft only about like the art that we make intentionally, but how we express ourselves. I want to be a little bit more empathetic on the tool topics, because yes, if you your whole life have been writing on a certain kind of paper that is handmade and everything, like we talked before, the speed and the sensation that you have with the other tool that you're writing with is going to affect the message that you are giving. Hmm? You just talked about how we are rushed because it's something that's happening globally because of globalization. We are rushed by the need of disposing. See?
Yes.
And the need of fixing the thing. Like, if it's too slow, it's broken, so I need to do it faster. What do you think about that shift, that change of the speed that we are going through?
So one of the ways in which my point of view, having worked on the Endangered Alphabets Project for more than 15 years, is that I have this kind of, it's as if I've been on a journey around the world. And not only have I seen all these things around the world, but now I can look back home. It's very much like somebody who travels for the first time, and when they come back home, they see their own culture, their own activities, in an entirely different light. So, for example, in after the Second World War, the many, many islands that are now called Indonesia fought a war of independence. Previously, some of them had been British colonial possessions, Dutch colonial possessions, that briefly occupied by the Japanese, etc. And when they gained independence, this new nation, which called itself Indonesia, had this problem. There were 17,000 islands. There were six major religions. I think it was the fifth largest population in the world. How do they provide a sense of coherence? And so they decided they needed a national language, which they called Indonesian. It's pretty much Malay. And they also needed a national writing system or script. And they decided to use the Latin alphabet because, you know, it's the alphabet of the future. It's the alphabet of the world. What that meant was that all over these 17,000 islands, the people who had been learning and teaching their own traditional scripts started teaching the Latin alphabet instead. In many cases, they kept their own language, but they started writing it as well as they could with the Latin alphabet. So what that meant was that within two generations, virtually nobody could read those traditional scripts. So I got an email from a young woman in Jakarta, in Indonesia, who said that she had come across a stash of letters written by her grandfather, who had actually been a soldier in the Indonesian War of Independence. And she really wanted to know what it had been like for him, what his beliefs had been, what the conditions and circumstances had been in, how you fight for a new nation that doesn't yet exist. You know, all of these really interesting questions, but the letters were in the traditional Javanese script and she couldn't read them. So she was teaching herself the Javanese script so that she could reconnect with her family, with her grandfather, with her entire cultural ancestry. And I thought, this is really interesting because in the United States, exactly the opposite is happening, where you now have generations being educated who can't read the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights because they're written in cursive script. And so our movement, this sort of headlong rush toward the future, is actually causing a division. It's at the moment, it's a generational division between children and their grandparents, but it's also a cultural division between the kids who are growing up and looking toward the future and all of the documents that illustrate and inform about their history, their background, but also their rights. I mean, we are at a time in American history where the government is systematically removing these documents about rights from government websites. And so we're actually literally seeing the disappearance of the culture and history that in theory we believe in. So in, as I say, elsewhere in the world, you're getting a reunification where people are rediscovering their roots, their history, their sense of who they are, their sense of pride. And here we're in exactly the opposite situation.
When you talk about privilege, the other day that we spoke, we were talking about the invitation that you made about us linguists and curious about languages, learning a new script besides our own, right? And with this Indonesian case of them choosing a new alphabet, or not choosing a new alphabet, I'm sorry, choosing their lingua franca, their writing system, they were actually super pretty well-intended when they chose the Latin alphabet because it's the future and globalization and whatnot. That same motivation is the one that is being replicated, and now we see the results of that decision, right? So I like to talk about privilege like that. You know, it's not like a something that you just say like, yeah, we are going to end this different culture, because I mean there's no motivation or wrong motivation behind that decision, but we now see that the consequences of unifying all these scripts get to be detrimental and harming memory. You know, yeah. Memory is I think that's one of the main concepts of this conversation, memory. Your friend, your Indonesian friend, she's asking herself about the motivations of her grandparent, right? And getting in touch with that script definitely should tune something within her head. And you were talking about also what the writing communicates. You are not talking about the meaning of the definition of each character. Is why is it like that? It is pretty particular. If I started like inventing a new script just because I want to do it, it's not going to be as meaningful or fascinating, because I don't have the same need, because it's not a thing from memory or rescuing anything. It's just for fun, see? And I think that the analogy that you said about traveling and then coming back to your town, and then you see the difference in your own structure and how that paradigm is fixed, and you couldn't see it before, but now you can. It's the same way it should work with scripts, right? Like you start exploring a new script or finding out about the relationship of other cultures with their scripts, and you might start to understand the deep variety and diversity within the human mind that allows you to develop all these infinite, fascinating, different ways of writing, right?
So I'm sure that your listeners, because, you know, multilingual obviously is so much speaks to and for the translation localization industry. All of your listeners, every single one of them, will have come across somebody at some point who said, wouldn't it just be easier if we all spoke the same language, right? And the answer is, sure, let's all speak Kazakh, right? Or let's all speak Malayalam. And they don't mean let's all speak the same language. They mean let's all speak my language. And one of the issues of privilege is that it really makes you lazy and blind. So if you never have to speak another language, or in particular, in terms of my work, you never have to read another script, you become really bad at learning languages or learning scripts. If, on the other hand, I discovered, and it was like a slap in the face, so the average educated Indian from India, right, knows at least 4 different scripts and may well use them every day. And so for them, learning a new script is fun. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that's what they do here, and how does this work? And for someone like me, who grew up only ever using one script, it's ironic, you know, I carve all of these different scripts and all these carvings, but if I were to see a piece of writing, I'd be like, ah, you know, I have no idea even how to go about doing this. Plus, I have no idea how much these scripts mean to the people who use them, because even though, you know, as an Englishman growing up, I knew about the Welsh language. I knew that there were remnants of Irish and Scottish, for example, and I know and respect people who are involved in the revival movements of many of these minority languages, including Breton and Catalan, and, you know, etc. Every single one of them uses the Latin alphabet. And so when I speak to people about endangered languages, people know what I mean. You know, they could list several minority languages just like that. And I'm sure you know many minority languages of Central and South America, for example. But if I say endangered alphabets, people have no idea what I mean, because the only one they've ever seen is the Latin alphabet. It is used by 75% of the world as the primary or secondary writing system. And so consequently, it doesn't matter to us. It's like linguistic duct tape. You know, if we have to do something, you know, that's what we use it for. The idea that the Welsh feel deeply about the Welsh language makes sense to me. The idea that the Britons feel deeply about the Breton language makes sense to me. But the idea of feeling deeply about the Latin alphabet when everybody uses it, it doesn't make sense. And it's only when I say to you, for example, I've carved a piece of text in a script that is used by one village in northeastern India, one village. And the piece of text that I carved in that script is, if we lose our books, we will lose ourselves. Because from then on, if they lose their script, if it isn't taught anymore, if there are no longer things written in it that they can read, etc., essentially they become somebody else's poor cousins. They become, and what's more, they're poor cousins that nobody else cares about, and nobody cares about their history or knows about their feast days, for example, or their dances, or their heroes, or the struggles that they've been through to stay alive when they were driven out of their original native lands, etc. Nobody else cares about that. And so that's why, even though we're talking about issues of written and spoken language, we're also talking about issues of identity, social justice, and human rights.
We were talking about the irony then of standardization. Yes. Yes, it would be. That's one of the things that people say the most. No, like, why can everybody just speak the same language and that's it? I see it like as a garden, you know, and appreciating the diversity and capability that we all have to express in infinite different forms, and accepting it. Like, yes, it's okay that I don't get it, but it looks amazing. It looks beautiful, and I'm sure it is as deep as my own thought. I think that's one of the main invitations of caring for different scripts. Linguistic duct tape. Can you talk a little bit about that? I love that term.
So the great thing about duct tape is you can use it for just about anything, right? You can use it to fix anything. And for example, I just scribbled a note down here about something that I wanted to remember to say with you, right? And if we regard writing in that way, we don't understand a culture where they have, let's say, two or even three forms of writing, one of which is only to be used for sacred purposes. We don't understand what a sacred script is. And that's, you know, you see that if you see somebody holding a Bible, you know, there's nothing special about the way it's printed. There's nothing special about the way it's bound. It's black, it's got white paper, whatever. And the letters, the printing that's in it is exactly the same that's used for anything else. And yet there are many cultures where the act of writing is a holy act. It's an act of dignity and respect. And in Balinese, for example, there's a character called the pamada, which you put in a piece of text before doing a piece of writing that is sacred. And so what it does is it says, read this with reverence. Read this knowing that this isn't just somebody saying some words to you. This is sacred and holy, and it's worth your entire attention. It is more important than other things that you will do with the act of writing. And there are special characters in Javanese that indicate respect. And that's why I've become so interested in handwriting that, we've increasingly lost the act of handwriting as a gesture of caring and respect. I was talking to somebody today who said that he had handwritten a note to the parents of one of his children he teaches, is a teacher. And the fact that it was a handwritten note, he met her at some school event, and she took out a Ziploc plastic bag from her purse. And in that bag was the letter that he had written saying something good about her son. And she said, "I always carry this with me." And I thought, email doesn't cut it.
Not one bit. Not one bit. Like, the systems that we use to express ourselves, definitely, of course, talk about. That's what we're saying here.
Yeah,
exactly. I think that's clear. That's why I wanted to go back to the tools. The technological developments are, like, especially now that we're talking about writing, we don't write anymore, we type. What can you say about that? Like, what is the importance or why should we keep writing, handwriting?
Right. And this is what my next book, which is called By Hand, is all about. And all of this came kind of like vividly clear to me just a few weeks ago when I realized that, let's say, when I first started working as a writer, as a professional writer, you could buy all of the writing equipment you needed to be a writing professional for less than the cost of a day's salary, even though obviously it was much less than it is now. And so consequently, there was nobody who could make money, could become rich off you buying a pencil, or a pad of paper or something like that. Nowadays, every time I go on my laptop, I get ads from Grammarly. And Grammarly is saying, write faster, write better. So first of all, when you write faster, you actually write worse because you don't give yourself time to reflect on what you're saying. Here's another phrase for you. If you write off the top of your head, then what you get is verbal dandruff. So the faster you write, the more likely you are to get verbal dandruff. Secondly, Grammarly has the opportunity to make hundreds of millions of dollars by convincing you that the purpose of writing is to be as fast as possible. And so consequently, that changes, as you say, the tools. So I have a nice calligraphy pen. And I this morning, for example, I went to my local cafe and I sat down and I wrote in my journal with my calligraphy pen. And it changes the way I think. It changes the way I think about what my writing looks like. It changes my sense of the value of my own thinking and of the value that I want to give someone else by writing something, because I believe that at heart, writing is a gift from somebody to somebody else. But if I'm thinking my job is to write as fast as possible and get this done, then I'm not there. And I had a fascinating experience when I was writing this book by hand, that one day I did a bunch of writing and editing on typing on my laptop, and then I stopped I went to open my journal to do some writing, and I couldn't write because my mind was so attuned to being as fast as possible and cutting and pasting and bringing stuff in, etc., etc., that I literally had to alter the brain waves before I could slow down enough and respect myself and my reader and the act of writing enough for my handwriting to be legible. And that's when I thought, this is fascinating, because my handwriting is telling me something that I don't even want to hear.
Beautiful, because it's all about, I think this is a lot to do with the depth of the message, because yes, writing fast is just get it out, just say whatever it is that you need to say so the other person can get it, because then we are understanding the message only as the content of what's right. being written, not the form. The form says something different, yes? If the form is typed and is like a digital message that comes through WhatsApp or email, a more formal way to express, it says something very different than if it's handwritten.
Yes. And what's more, the more we get used to that, one of the sad things that I came across time and again as I was writing this book was people, especially younger people, saying, I don't have the time to write like that anymore, or I don't like my handwriting because I'm so used to typing. I hate the look of my handwriting, so I don't do it. Or saying that handwriting is just a form of nostalgia and the world is changing and we should get used to that fact. And when you say that, you're sort of, the subtext is, I'm okay with obliterating my past. Kind of an interesting notion when you think about it. I'm okay with obliterating my own past.
Yes, you can say that same thing with different words, like, I am okay with just following the flow, you know, just...
Yeah.
It makes me question a lot because, yes, when I myself am writing because I like to take notes in my physical... with my physical tools...
Yeah.
And when I start writing, I just want to finish. I'm like, okay, I just want to say whatever it is in my head so I can just quit this thing and go back to whatever I was doing.
Right.
And yes, that is the fast, the hurry, the let's get it done of the fast-paced world we live in, right? Every time more and more and more because we need to get things done. It's production. It's taking it out with no much consideration.
So here's the thing. I have this thing that I say in my book that the future of writing depends on what we think it is. So if we think that writing is essentially a chore, something that we need to get done, and again, the ads all represent writing as a chore. You know, I've got this paper that I've got to get done. I've got this report I've got to write, etc. Then it makes sense for us to think, how can I deal with this as if it were a chore? And if there is a technical, if there's, let's call it a robot, that will do my job for me, then why would I not pass the job over to the robot? And that there are several things about that. One is that it means that you never think about writing anything that actually means something to you, because you've already defined writing as something that you just have to do. And so the notion of writing a letter by hand, or deciding you're going to write your family history, for example, or just deciding you're going to keep a journal and be philosophical or whatever, that doesn't occur to you because you're already thinking, get it done, get it over with. Secondly, It means that you've lost any sense of writing as a means of reaching out to somebody in a meaningful way. It's just now something that you just got to get done and get off your plate. And all of those mean that, of course, you're going to use AI whenever you can, because that's the fastest and the newest and flashiest of all of those robots. It also means, and you touched on this earlier, that you are giving up part of what you might get out of life. So there is an app I came across, which basically says, we will write your novel for you. And we, you know, our AI will analyze the market, and it will say, these are the genres that are most underserved right now, and will give you the best rate of return. And then the AI will write the novel for you, and you're done. And I'm thinking, you write a novel because you want to write a novel. And once you start saying, writing is just something that I need to get off my plate, then all of those things that you might do with writing or painting or composing music or all of those things that we're supposed to do it when we have the time to do them. You know, you make the time to do them, and then, you know, you get the robot to do it for you. So it really comes down to this absolutely profound philosophical question, which is, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to get out of your life? And if what you want to get out of your life is, I want to avoid doing anything that seems the remotest bit like hard work, you are going to have a pretty empty life.
Thank you for saying it. I believe that this, like, the purpose of doing things is being so questioned. Like, constantly, of course, that's the big question. Like, why do we do things for? Yeah. And I think we are already, like you said, we already answered that question. We just want to do it because it can be done fast and easy. If not, I don't want to do it.
And, so imagine there was a bot that would do your show for you. You know, it can take your speech patterns, it can digest the material that you're thinking of doing and put it into questions in your speech patterns. It's like, yes, that's just taken away the high point of my week, right?
Yes, and it's so crazy because I think that we used to do a lot of things, and every time, like, with the technology development and whatnot, we have been able to do less. And now, like, finding out ourselves and rescuing our identity, that is a key word in this conversation and with language, it's like learning how to do things that we ourselves chose to forget because of technology. So I think it also affects the capability of listening.
Yeah.
Right? Because, yes, I mean, is this a paradigm, is something that is implemented in all of your aspects, right? So quick, fast, commercial.
That'll do. I know what you mean.
Thank you. It's just that I wanted to be proper because of the listeners, you know, I want to use the commercial. Is that the word, commercial?
What you've done is you have coined a word. So there's the word commercial. I mean, and that means, you know, for the sake of earning money. But commercial sort of means something that is capable of being commercial. So you've just invented a word. I like it.
Thank you.
And by the way, your spell checker would have corrected that. It wouldn't have allowed you to say that.
You see, we have to stop using computers. Of course, that is not the message. Asking people this bunch of things and exposing this it's observation of the world and how we have chosen to develop everything. It shows up, it shows us that privilege standpoint.
Very much so. And in fact, there's a really interesting development that's taking place right now in my field of endangered alphabets. So many of your listeners will know all about the Unicode and digitizing scripts, all this kind of thing. And there is a strong initiative to digitize what are called digitally underserved communities or digitally disadvantaged communities. And these are ones where if you have a script, then chances are you can't use it on your keyboard or on your phone because the technology has not yet applied to a minority script what is already readily available to a majority script. And so that would also apply to optical character recognition, which can read, you know, it can read English, but it can't necessarily read, say, Javanese. So part of the issue there is that many of these minority cultures who have these scripts live in areas where there's no reliable electricity, let alone no reliable internet signal. And so to really support them, the answer in the long term may be to create these digital tools, but in the short term, they may need stuff that's actually on pencil and paper, that actually may need, chalk and a blackboard. So the whole idea that the world can be rescued if we digitize the whole world is one that, again, it's the way we look at it, but it isn't necessarily the way everybody looks at it.
I agree. And how would you describe the need of just the common human being, the common worker, to get curious about scripts, about different scripts than their own?
Yeah. So everything comes down to mutual respect. So even the notion that an educated person in the West is interested in a minority culture may not be enough, because that doesn't necessarily mean there's mutual respect. And I run into this, and I'm guilty of this all the time, because, for example, I post my carvings on various Facebook groups where that the culture can see their own work and they love it. But if they then reply in a minority script, I can't read it. It's really not an equal exchange. And everything has to start with that notion of equal respect. And so to talk in terms of majority scripts and minority scripts, it's already, you're halfway to saying these are the more important ones and these are the kind of starving children we should feed a little bit, you know. And it's only when you realize, it's really only when you've been on the other side, you realize this is why my trip to Bangladesh in 2012 was so important, because I got to see what it was like for the people who, for example, one guy who became a friend of mine grew up in the Chittagong Hill districts of Bangladesh. And he was an ethnic Marma. So this is an ethnic minority in that region. And when he was really, really looking forward to his first day of school. And so he went to school, you know, he walked through the jungle, you know, mile, 2 miles, whatever. He gets to school. They're probably all sitting on the floor. And the teacher starts talking. And the teacher is talking in Bangla, which is the official national language. He doesn't speak Bangla. Most of the kids in the class don't speak Bangla. They speak their own languages. And eventually, the teacher catches him, like, looking across the room or out of the window or whatever, because he doesn't understand what the teacher is saying. And the teacher calls him up to the front of the class and beats him with a cane for not paying attention. And in the Hill Tracks, this figure may be out of date, but even if it is, it's not going to be very different. At the time that he and I started talking about this, which was in 2012, only 1.6% of children in the Hill Tracks finished their education. And about 80% never went beyond the fifth grade, because everything about their education was essentially, as I've said, a form of cultural genocide. We're not going to provide books. They had never seen writing in their own script until I did some carvings that went up on the walls, and they're like, wow. And then my students and I created some educational materials for them in their own language, in their own script. And that's transformational. But the government was not happy about it, because if you have been repressing a minority for some time and someone comes along and wants to help them achieve some degree of equality, that's a threat.
Yes, I cannot avoid to see the political filter of all this conversation. It's impossible. I mean, what do you think? Is it possible to talk about this or get involved in this conversation, like actually get involved into the conversation without getting into politics?
It depends really what you mean by politics. So politics is, you know, it can be party politics, it can be national politics. It can be the power relationships between two people. So if you and I are having a conversation and I'm your boss, already there's a political imbalance between the two of us. And the amount of power you have comes down to how much I allow you to have. And so when you have minority groups, the amount of progress they can make is a political conversation. And it depends. For example, if you look at Morocco and Algeria, so that the Amazigh people have been inhabiting North Africa for thousands of years, and they've been using writing for at least a couple of thousand years. But because they were marginalized by the Romans and then by the Arabs and then by the French, their position was that their language was actually banned, and it was illegal, for example, to give your child an Amazigh name, I believe, in Algeria. So there's been, in Morocco, there's a more liberal government, and they've actually set up a department for researching the language and the culture and creating educational materials in the Amazigh languages and the Tifinagh script. Algeria, where there was a much more bloody war, a civil war, and the government has been much more repressive, the progress of the Amazigh people there is much slower.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Tim, for your considerations. Tell me a little bit about your book.
It's called By Hand. By Hand. Yes. So it really all began with exactly what we've been talking about. You know, what is the value of handwriting? What is the importance of handwriting? How does handwriting change you if you use it? Why is it that it is so important for the cultural revival of various people around the world and so unimportant, especially in the United States? And then what can be done about it? You can't change anything by simply saying, okay, we're going to mandate handwriting in schools, and then we're just going to like punish kids by hitting their hands with a ruler if they can't handwrite very well. You know, so it's a really, really interesting and complex question. And so fairly early on, I decided, I actually originally thought I'm going to write this whole book by hand and then publish it as a manuscript book. And then I had this crisis where I thought my handwriting isn't good enough. And I thought nobody under the age of 30 is going to be able to read it. And so I continued to write it by hand with this great calligraphy pen I now have. And my handwriting, which had been terrible because all I've been using it for is scribbling in notes, you know, for the last 30 years of my life. My handwriting got better and better, and eventually I started writing in public, and people would come over to me and say, "It is so nice to see somebody writing with a pen." I mean, literally, it happens every time now. So the book really investigates writing very much from a personal point of view. What am I learning by watching myself try to write? What shapes the letters? This is sort of a fascinating thing in itself, because when kids are taught handwriting, they're taught these are symbols, you have to learn how to write them, and this is something that you do over and over until you get it right. Whereas actually, half of the act of handwriting has to do with the structure and movement of the wrist and the hand. And that the most successful handwriting teaching teaches it as a form of movement, almost as a form of dance. Because if you, and I did this quite recently and I was amazed, if you just take a sheet of paper and a nice big thick marker pen or something, and you make whatever marks come naturally to your hand, and then you do this and you do this, you know, around the piece of paper, you realize that those are the prototype shapes of writing as we know it. And that if you can do this as an act of pleasure and then shape that into the letters you need, all of a sudden writing becomes something that you're enjoying doing rather than something that's making your hand cramp up. And if you talk to graffiti artists, they will tell you this is exactly what it's like. It's this full body experience where you are throwing the whole of yourself into creating this writing slash art form, which is expressive in a way you were never allowed to be in school. So, the book is called By Hand, and if you go to endangeredalphabets.com and you click on the shop icon, then you can pre-order it there, and it should be ready in October or November. And of course, on the cover, I want to show you something. On the cover, I actually carved the cover. So this is the basis. I carved it in maple. And so we're going to photograph this, and then that wraps around and becomes the cover of the book. And then on that, I'm going to photograph my calligraphy pen. So everything is done by hand. And that's my writing. So
beautiful. Thank you, Tim. One of the things that I like the most about this show is that it's based on the fact to me that everything is just one thing. And when we name stuff and when we set these categories and tags and whatever, we are just trying to, you know, to encasillar.
Compartmentalize, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, like to put little things in boxes, right? But then somehow somebody is going to show you something about that box that is going to make it meaningless. Like, okay, that box is not what I thought it was. So we were talking about art. We talked about development, about technology, about politics in one topic alone, which is handwriting and script.
Yeah, exactly.
We talked about memory. Is everything is just, let's say, boxed and just in your thing, in the thing that you are passionate about.
And I have this saying that I now use about handwriting, which is it's under your nose, but it's also under the radar. So nobody, it's right there, but we don't look at it. We don't think about it. Everybody does it, to varying degrees of skill or pleasure or whatever. But it's something that we don't give the thought that it is due.
Thank you for that final thought. This has been a very interesting mind-carving conversation. Now, is there anything else you would like to say before we go?
Just how grateful I am that you've put so much thought in on a subject that most people don't think about. That's your gift to me.
Thank you for listening to Echoes of Meaning. My name is Camila Sabogal. I'm a media producer at Multilingual Media. And if today's conversation stayed with you, I'd really appreciate it if you left a comment or rated the podcast whenever you're listening. It helps more people find these stories and the meaning behind them. See you next month. And let's remember to listen.